Well, hello, everybody. I am so excited to introduce you to a wonderful elder law attorney. He is pretty much a rock star in the elder law community. This is Robert Fleming. So welcome, Robert.
Thank you. Kind word.
Absolutely. I would love to read just a little bit about you before we get started. So Robert has practiced elder law in Tucson, Arizona since 1976. He's been active in the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, the American College of Trust and Estate Counsel, and the Special Needs Alliance, among other organizations. He's a frequent lecturer on issues involving the legal representation of seniors, those with disabilities, and family members of both. So before we get into our topic about the importance of advanced care planning, elder law, all the various, just tell us a little bit about your practice, the scope of your practice in Tucson.
Sure. There are about four lawyers in our practice, so we're a relatively small office, and all we do is what you might call elder law, guardianship, conservatorship, estate planning, long-term care planning. We do a lot of work with special needs children. Of course, they're not always children, but often children or adult children of our clients. The clients planning for the future needs of their child with special needs. And that's really all of our focus. And we've been doing that. My longtime partner, Tom Curdy, and I have been doing it off and on since 1976 together and full-time together since 1994, okay. Which in law practice partnership terms is like dog years, you know, it's about 150 years we've been together.
Well, and speaking of dogs, I want everybody to visit your website, which is elder-law.com, because you've got a couple of videos on there that speak about dogs and baking bread. Do you want to share a little bit about that?
Sure. We are a very dog-friendly office. Odin, my dog, comes to work every day with me. He's not in the office with me now because he has a tendency to get excited when somebody walks by and start barking. And I didn't want to interrupt our meeting. He's in one of the, we're actually spread across several buildings, and he's in one of the other buildings with one of his girlfriends. He makes the daily round.
How nice.
And another dog, Duncan, regularly, not every day, but regularly comes to the office. So both of those office members regularly greet clients, and a lot of our clients, we have an extremely good coffee machine in the front, so a lot of our clients make sure they make their appointments in the morning so they can get good coffee and bring treats for the dogs. The bread baking reference is just that our office is in an old house, and we try to make it as homey and comfortable and non-threatening as possible. One of the ways we do that is once a week or so, we fire up a bread machine, primarily, frankly, for the smell of bread. People come in and say, oh, this is just like my grandmother's house. and we really encourage that sense that we're not scary, difficult people to deal with.
That is so amazing. If we can put a man on the moon, I want somebody to figure out how to incorporate smell with video.
Well, yeah.
I'd love to smell that bread right this minute.
Well, we toyed for a little while with chocolate chip cookies, but everybody in the office put on about 10 pounds. And let's go back to bread.
Yeah, right. Okay, so it's an honor to have you here. I know our viewers probably have 100 questions that they would love to ask you individually, so we're going to try to just hit some of the major points that a lot of people are curious about when it comes to elder law. So I do have some questions here, and we'll just sort of run through them. So what is the single most important document you should have signed before you need it?
And that's a question that I like posing just that way. Of course, everybody needs to do estate planning. Every lawyer in the world will tell you, you really need to go talk to somebody about getting your estate in order. But the truth is, the government has written a will for you that's probably pretty close to what you want. It probably leaves everything to your children or to your spouse if you have a spouse. It probably gives your spouse or your children priority for appointment as executor. So if you don't sign a will, that might not make very much difference. It doesn't increase the taxes. It doesn't increase usually the cost of probate. And so that's, you know, it's important to do that, but it's not really critical. step in your planning. Most people, when they do their estate planning, also get around to signing a financial power of attorney, and that's terribly important as well. Unlike your will, the legislature hasn't written a mechanism for somebody to handle your finances for you if you become incapacitated. So if you don't do something, if you don't do some planning, there can be some serious costs involved.
And but is that called a durable power of attorney?
Durable power of attorney or financial power of attorney. And there is a little state-to-state variation in the terms that are most commonly used.
Okay.
But the thing that I think is the single most important document for people to sign, and partly because it's so easy to do, is a healthcare power of attorney. If you have strong feelings about how your end-of-life decisions are going to be made, that's the single most important document you can sign. And it's it really is easy to do. Your state probably has a form that's available online or pretty widely available. You can go to a, do they still have stationery stores? You can go to an office supply store or stationery store and pay $50 for the forms, but you can also get them free online. They're pretty straightforward to fill out in most states. And so it's really easy to do. If you don't do that, in most states, some family member may have the ability to make healthcare decisions for you, but they may have restrictions on their ability. For instance, in Arizona, where I practice, the one thing that a family member can't do if you haven't signed some sort of a document is remove life-sustaining treatment, tube feeding and artificial hydration, which is exactly what most people want to sign a healthcare power of attorney to do. So I think that's probably the most important single document to do, followed fairly quickly by a financial power of attorney.
Yeah.
You can also sign a living will at the same time you sign a healthcare power of attorney, and that's useful and important, and I don't want to minimize the value of doing that. But the reality is that a living will is a static document that says, here's what I want. A healthcare power of attorney designates someone who you've given authority to run up and down the hallways of the hospital waving the document and yelling, I'm in charge, and that's a much more potent document.
And I really want to underscore that, because a lot of people, they know the term living will and they think it covers everything. They don't realize it's very limited to just, it really is just about the machines that will keep you alive if you did not, if you were not hooked up to those machines. So like you said, the ventilation, artificial nutrition, hydration, it doesn't cover so many other things. Like, do we cut this arm off, or do we do another round of chemo, or all these other things that come up when you're talking about somebody's health care. So if you can talk a little bit more about that health care power of attorney, that is a living, breathing person, and what are the types of decisions that they will, when does it come into effect, and what kinds of decisions can that person make for you?
Sure. In most states, the healthcare power of attorney is effective only when the principal is unable to make their decisions. Even if that were not what is said in the document, no doctor is going to look at you in the hospital bed and then turn to your husband and say, what does she want? They're going to first ask you. So effectively, the power of attorney really is only when you're unable to tell the doctor what you want.
Exactly.
The range of decisions, you're absolutely right. It's far more than just tube feedings and the machinery to keep people alive, as they usually say euphemistically. My favorite illustration is a kind of a simple and obvious one, and that is active treatment for pneumonia. Pneumonia used to be called the old man's friend. Pneumonia is how people actually die.
Mm-hmm.
If you have not given somebody permission to withhold antibiotic treatment for pneumonia, you could be cured from the thing that would actually allow you to die at the end of life. Cured, be put back on artificial respiration and hydration. And so that's where the agent under your healthcare power of attorney is really valuable, because you can't predict, is it going to be pneumonia? Is it going to be tube feeding? Is it going to be dialysis? What is going to be the treatment that is keeping you alive that you would have rejected? And that's key. And it's also key to understand that some people consider all those treatments and say, no, I want it all. I want every possible treatment because I do not want to die, or maybe morally, I think that the decision to allow somebody to die is only God's decision. It's not a decision for my agent or the doctors. Well, then you doubly need to sign a healthcare power of attorney, because today the system is going to assume that you would not want those treatments, and you're going to get extra treatment. I'm sorry, you're not going to get the extra treatment that you want if that's how you feel. So you need to think about what you want. You need to have that conversation with the person you name as your agent, and you need to sign the healthcare power of attorney.
And the viewers of this telesummit, I really hope that they are getting loud and clear. It's so important to have the conversation. Yes, it's important to get the documents, but you must make sure that this person heard come out of your mouth what you want, when you want it, and when you don't want it anymore. And I just want to also clarify the term agent. So for people that aren't familiar with all these terms, the agent is just another name for that person that you selected to make your decisions for you if you are not able to do that for yourself, correct?
Correct. And because we're lawyers, we can't make this simple, we who wrote these laws across the country. So in some states, the person who I refer to as an agent is called an advocate or a surrogate in other states.
Right.
No matter what language your state uses or the community, sometimes it's not state law, it's just practice that's grown up. It doesn't matter which term. I'll usually say agent as shorthand because it's easier than saying attorney in fact, which is another common name for the person. That's the person you name in the power of attorney.
So the real difference, the living will is a piece of paper that covers life-sustaining measures. The healthcare power of attorney is the document, the healthcare power of attorney document. The purpose of it is to designate a living, breathing person to speak for you when you're not able to speak for yourself.
Right. And that's exactly right. I usually say the living will is instructions to your healthcare agent. Hey, Tina, I'm naming you as my agent, and here's a document that says what I want you to do with that authority.
That's right.
You know, your point about having the conversation, there's actually a project. If you look for the conversation project, they really are promoting having this conversation once a year or so among the family. But that conversation is critically important. And part of what's critically important about it is you can't just have it with the child you've named as your agent. You also have to have it with the child you didn't name as your agent. I can't tell you how many times I've heard from family members, my sister is pulling mom's plug and I know she wouldn't want that. Let's hire a lawyer. Let's all lawyer up and go fight about what mom would want. Well, if mom had told the dissenting daughter, son, grandchild, whatever, what she wanted, then that would head that off at the very beginning.
So what advice do you give your clients who don't have, there's no illness yet, no crisis? What is your best advice for our listeners and our viewers about when do you put this document, when do you do this?
You do it early. If you think about the cases where you've heard of somebody who was kept alive long beyond the time most people would want to not be sustained, all of the stories that you know, or virtually all the stories you know, are about women in their 20s. They're not about 70-year-old women at the end of life, or 70-year-old men. It's consistent that, you know, Karen Ann Quinlan and Nancy Beth Cruzan and all of the names that are well known in the literature, in the popular literature, are all young women. So they should have been signing those documents on their 18th birthday or shortly thereafter in order to have prevented the legal proceedings that went on afterward. Most people that we see have not done that in their 20s. So realistically, what's the date by which it needs to be done? By the time you get your AARP card, you need to have signed these documents.
Right.
At least by then, earlier if you can possibly do it.
Right.
But here's the other thing about that. You need to share those documents. I tell people your will, your trust, don't share it if you don't want to. They're private documents. Maybe you want your kids to know what your plans are. Maybe you don't. but share the healthcare power of attorney, share it with everybody. Hand a copy of it to every member of the family. And I'm a big fan of doing that on at a, you know, a point in time. Okay, we're going to all get together. We're going to sit down for dinner. We're going to also have a short conversation about advanced directives. You're all going to get a copy of my advanced directive. And I like to joke with clients, you know, there's that one time when everybody's there, when you've misjudged how long a turkey takes to cook, just before Thanksgiving dinner is the perfect time. I haven't gotten much traction with that.
I mean, whether it's Thanksgiving or whenever it is, I will often tell people, because, you know, this isn't something people like to talk about. Nobody likes to think about losing someone they love. But I will recommend very similarly, you know, pull the family together, do a spaghetti dinner, bring out your beverage of choice, whatever the case may be. And then maybe for those that don't really want to talk about it, start with describing your perfect last day on the planet. Mm-hmm. So that's a fun pie in the sky thing. You know, like for me, I want the dog on the bed. I want Louis Armstrong playing It's a Wonderful World in the background, and I want it to be on loop, you know, constantly. That's my favorite song. I want someone baking some kind of cobbler or maybe bread in the oven so I can smell it. I've got a list of people I want to be sure there. I have another list of a few people I want to be sure are not there. And I want somebody holding my hand around the clock. They'll just have to do shifts. I'm sorry about that. But I want somebody holding my hand. So that's what I want. And that can be a fun conversation. And I'm telling you, Robert, people will learn things about their loved one that's important to them that they never knew if they didn't have that conversation. Then after you get do that kind of fun conversation, then jump into, okay, guys, you know, if the Mack truck were to hit, you know, this is what I want, this is what I don't want, under this scenario, that scenario, you know. So there's got to be a way to get these people comfortable starting this conversation.
Right, I agree. One of the things that we put in our form, Healthcare Power of Attorney, the one that we most often use in our practice, it says, I want to die, and I want and expect to die at home. And I'm surprised, it doesn't happen very often, maybe 5% of cases. I'm surprised when clients say, take that out. I don't want to die at home. I want to die in a hospital. I want to die somewhere that, you know, doesn't leave the lingering memory of my death in the bedroom or the living room of the family house or whatever reason they give. And the point of my bringing that up is, that surprises me, might surprise their kids too. They need to have that kind of detail of conversation. So I'm totally on board with your describe the best last day that you can imagine.
Yeah.
And if your mother were to say, and it would be in a hospital bed attended by capable medical personnel, you might say, really? Oh.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And statistically in the hospice industry, 80% of us say we want to die at home, which means 20% of us say we don't. And sometimes it's cultural reasons, sometimes it's religious reasons, and sometimes the example you gave is the perfect one, that they just don't want the family members coming into the house where their loved one died.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let me move along here. Let's see, what will happen if you're seriously ill and have made no plans?
So this is very state specific. Most, but not all states have adopted what are usually called surrogacy laws. The surrogacy notion is sort of like the will that the legislature has written for you. They've also, in many cases, but not all cases, written a sort of a healthcare power of attorney. They've said the person who can make healthcare decisions for you, if you haven't signed anything, is first your, typically they say, first your spouse, then your adult children, or a majority of your adult children if there's disagreement, or the only available adult children if it's hard to get hold of them. And then parents, because remember, this comes up sometimes for 25-year-olds. So they may not have children, but they still have parents involved.
Right.
And then other family members, more remote family members. And some states even say somebody who claims to be a friend and to know what you want. But the real point is, beyond spouse, it's not as likely that they got this one right as that they got the will that the legislature wrote for you right. So if that's not the priority list that you like, or if your state doesn't have a surrogacy statute, then you want to be signing a document to change that. But let's suppose that your state doesn't have, you haven't signed a document at all. What happens then? Guess what? We have to go to court. We have to get a guardianship over your person in order to withdraw the treatment. Not in every case. And people who hear this will recognize that they'll say, well, that didn't happen with my mother. Well, if there is unanimity and the doctors think that the care is futile and the death is going to occur anyway, they may agree to withdraw the treatment. But that's hit and miss. You can't rely on that happening. So if you feel strongly about not having treatment, there's a much higher likelihood that your wishes will be ignored if you have not signed documents. And worse than that, not only will your wishes be ignored, but your family will be put to considerable expense, and the final decision will be made not by family members, but by a guy wearing a black dress who is, he's a nice guy, he knows what he's doing, he's well educated, but he's not really tuned into your family or your personal situation.
Yeah, that is so scary. And I know in North Carolina, where people would think the spouse comes first, if there's no paperwork saying that, it doesn't. It could be the guardian before the spouse. So definitely for the viewers, come to understand what your state laws say. And no matter what they say, you need to get these documents done. So whatever your wishes are and who comes in what order. And it, also getting back to the healthcare power of attorney, you mentioned multiple siblings. My understanding, you tell me, the healthcare power of attorney is not, it's not a decision by committee. It's one person speaking for the patient, and then I believe you can have a secondary person designated, even a third, if you can't get a hold of that first person, if you can speak to that.
Sure. And again, this will be a lot of state to state variation. In most states, it's fine to name multiple agents, but now you have two kinds of problems. One is the difficulty of getting everybody on board. So let's suppose you have three children and you say, I just don't want to decide between them. I'm going to name all three of them as my agents. They'll have equal authority to act. And then when you get hit by that Mack truck, you've got to move it on from Mack trucks. It's got to be some kind of other truck. When you get hit by that truck and your daughter is traveling in Japan and your son is on his third honeymoon, and the only one they can get hold of is the one who is actually kind of the least qualified to make the decision. Are they going to accept that person? Are you going to get a good answer? So most lawyers will say, rather than put up with those kind of uncertainties, we'd rather you pick one. Mm-hmm. So figure some priority. Do it on some basis.
Yeah.
I don't care what your basis is. Is it proximity? Is it age? Is it medical training? Whatever you want to do, prioritize the kids.
And Robert, also, it doesn't have to be a family member, correct?
It does not have to be. And I tell clients, name anybody you want as your executor of your estate or personal representative of your estate. Name anybody you want as your trustee or your financial agent. Your healthcare power of attorney, it'd be really good to have them be local. Anybody can handle your estate from across the country or even from another country by fax and email and Skype and whatever. But it's a lot harder for them to really judge what kind of care you need. So that would be good to have it be a local person.
Yeah.
If it's not a local person, so be it. But you might consider a close friend who's lived next door to you for 40 years instead of your only child who lives clear across the country just because of the proximity for this one job and only for this job.
And I also think it's important that there are certain characteristics of that healthcare power of attorney, such as they are going to honor your wishes, not do what they want. They're going to be able to understand the options. They're going to be able to stand up to what is sometimes an overly aggressive medical community. And they're going to be strong enough to let go when it's time to let go. And cool. I know some family members just, they would never be able to let go.
That's not their strength, right? So think about that when you're choosing the person. Let's talk, if we can, for a minute about not about what you as a signer of a healthcare power of attorney should do, but what you, the agent under a healthcare power of attorney, should do.
Right.
That's a tough job. But you're exactly right, and it's critically important for agents to understand it's not them applying their wishes, it's them applying mom's or dad's wishes or whoever the principal who signed the power of attorney is. So if you have a living will that says withhold treatment, or for that matter, a living will that says provide treatment, and you disagree, you're supposed to do what they wanted, not what you think they ought to have wanted. And it also requires you, as you say, it requires you to have some familiarity with medical terms, some ability to get medical information, and the ability to stand up to a pretty tough system when they're trying to do something that your mom or your dad or your sister or brother, whoever it is, would not have wanted. For your own health care, you don't have any trouble arguing with the doctor and getting a second opinion and firing the doctor if they don't see things the same way you do. You got to be prepared to do all that for the principal that you're acting for as well.
Right, because you are speaking as if you were the patient. You're representing them and their wishes. And yeah, that's all extremely important. I just want to be sure I'm checking the time. I want to be respectful of your time. So let's see. So when should you begin your estate planning?
Again, you should do it the day you turn 18, but that's the number of 18-year-olds who actually get it together to do any of this planning is really a small number. The reality is that there's not too high a likelihood that you're going to die or become terminally ill for the next 20 or 30 or 40 years after your 18th birthday. But I think the reason that AARP starts bugging you on your 55th birthday, and it's creepy how they know when you have your 55th birthday. I don't know about you, but I got my first notice from AARP on my 55th birthday.
Really? Wow.
So if you've gotten an AARP notice, you need to be talking to a lawyer about your estate plan.
Estate planning has to do with the house, trust funds, all that, correct?
Younger people with minor children have another issue. They need to be thinking about who's going to take care of the kids if something should happen to them. And that should drag them into the lawyer's office to deal with that question, if nothing else. Happily married couples who know exactly what they want need to think about if something happened to both of them, how would their families get along? Because the families have not been living together as long as the parents have. And so does your mother and his mother have the same vision about who would take care of Johnny? Maybe not. So you need to designate. You need to talk that through and sign the documents.
Right. Let's see. Well, I did have a question about who's the right person to designate, who's going to make your decisions for you, and I think we touched on that. I do want to ask about this. You were involved in a litigation in the Arizona Supreme Court. The case was Rasmussen versus Fleming. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. And this is a pretty elderly case that happened in the 1980s. In the 1980s, there was a lot of litigation about when you could remove life-sustaining treatment from patients who were not going to recover. Mildred Rasmussen was an 80-year-old woman who had been in what's called a persistent vegetative state. So she had been unable to communicate, unresponsive, except on the basis of levels. She had a woman who came, she lived in a nursing home. She had a woman who came to visit her three or four times a week, who had never known her when she was competent, had volunteered to be an angel. She was a delightful lady who just went and talked to patients. And she insisted that Ms. Rasmussen didn't like country music. And she could tell that because if the staff was playing country music, she would kind of contort and twist away until classical music was on the radio.
Other than that, nobody
really saw any reaction from Ms. Rasmussen. I was Ms. Rasmussen's guardian. I was the public guardian, what's called the public fiduciary in Arizona. And so I asked for permission to withdraw the tube feeding that was really keeping her alive. And if I was granted permission, then the effect would be she would actually die of dehydration, not starvation. And she'd probably die in about a week, 10 days, maybe as long as 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And the court appointed a lawyer to represent Ms. Rasmussen, who didn't object to me having the ability to do that, but thought that there should be a specific proceeding where somebody had to testify affirmatively that she would want that. And my position was, well, she never signed anything. She never had this conversation with anybody, as so many people didn't and still don't. Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't have to keep her alive when her care is probably burdensome to her if she has any cognition at all. Mm-hmm. We ought to be able to make this decision for her. The probate judge agreed with me and gave me that permission. The court-appointed attorney appealed, and it ultimately went to the Arizona Supreme Court. And it is the lead case in Arizona. The ruling was in favor of my position. So it stands for the proposition that a guardian has the power to withdraw life-sustaining treatment, even though that will inevitably lead to the death of the patient. In so many of these cases, there are backstories and ironies, and this is such a case. While the case was pending in front of the Supreme Court, the doctor, the attending physician, was confident that we were going to prevail and we were going to remove the tube. And so he thought good care required that he try to feed her by a syringe feeding or something. And so the next time the tube came up for a routine cleaning, while it was out, by the way, one of the pieces of testimony was that when the tube came out for cleaning, she thrashed and resisted when it was put back in. That was, again, one of the very few instances of her reacting to anything.
Right.
So while it was out for cleaning, he tried squirting liquid and formula in the back of her throat. And guess what? She had a swallow reflex. She swallowed. She took 100 cc's of liquid and 100 calories, 1,000 cc's of liquid and 1,000 calories of nutrition every day for the rest of her life. She lived, and after we got permission to remove the tube feeding, she lived for another couple of years.
Wow.
And died of pneumonia, ultimately.
Right.
So
was she ever responsive again?
Never responsive, not in the slightest.
Wow. Those are such tough cases. Woo! Very, very tough cases. So we're just about out of time. So this has been such an honor. What are, I guess, some of the, like, parting words, comments, advice you want to give the viewers about if you haven't done this, you need to do this?
So let me talk a little bit about the thing that people do because it's more comfortable and easier to try to address these end-of-life issues. And that is they see a form online, and I'm going to particularly mention the most common one is called the Five Wishes form. And they think, I'll just fill that out and that'll get pretty close. It does get pretty close. And I encourage people to go look for the Five Wishes and read it. It's a very good pamphlet to help you think about the kinds of treatment that you're likely to be facing at the end of life and make you think about whether you would want that, whether you'd consider that to be too aggressive of care, or whether you would want it in every case. So I'm not bad-mouthing the Five Wishes at all. It's not enough, however. So I tell people, grab it, read it, you'll learn a lot, go ahead and fill it out. When it comes time to sign it, please get a hold of your state's advance directive form, because the Five Wishes form, even though it will be taken as indication of what you wish, it won't be a completely effective form in every state. In a lot of states, it'll be just fine. But don't take that chance. Use the form to help you form your opinions and direct, and to have the conversation with your family. But fill out your state's form. And by the way, have a copy of your state's form in the glove box when you go on your across the country, your motorhome trip to Branson. Particularly if you go to Branson, because Missouri is one of the couple of states that you really need to have affirmative evidence of your wishes in order to withdraw life-sustaining treatment. So,
yeah, that's a fabulous recommendation, is keep it in the glove compartment. And you're absolutely right. The five wishes, there's so many different tools, lasting matters, so many different tools out there to help people think about these things, write down what you want, maybe write your obituary, all these different things you want to think about. But it's not the same as a living will and a healthcare power of attorney document. And right. So they're great tools to help you put down, you know, all the things that you want to think about and what you want, but it's not the same as the legal document of the healthcare power of attorney.
Right.
So, yeah, excellent.
If you belong to a book club, next time, before you start the next book, grab a stack of five wishes and use that as your conversation.
Excellent idea.
I mean, you need to do this, but you also need to sign the proper form at the end of the process.
That's exactly right. In fact, we've got the Paul Malley, who's the CEO of the organization that created Five Wishes. He's going to be a part of this telesummit. So,
That's it.
Absolutely. Well, Robert Fleming, let me remind the people of your website. It's very easy to remember because it's simply elder-law.com. I mean, I don't know how you scored that URL, but good for you. And they are in Tucson, Arizona. And Robert has just one of the pages on his website shows all the different things that their practice covers. It's vast and anything elder law related. So I encourage you to check them out. But thank you so much for your time. I know you're an extremely busy man, but this has been really, really valuable.
Do please come to our website and you can meet Odin on the website.
The dogs. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you again so much. This has been extremely helpful. Very, very helpful.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you.